The 100 Years' War. The White Company period, 1357 to 1359. The Campaign in the Loire, 1358, part 2, the fall of Auxerre. In the last few days of October, 1358, Robert Knowles left Chateau Neuf and advanced east into the Nervais. At the end of the month, they occupied Malicorne, the great castle belonging to Margaret de Courtenay, situated in an isolated, densely wooded country about 20 miles west of Auxerre. Here they established a fresh center for exacting fees and long-distance raiding. When the archpriest returned from Provence early in November 1358, he found the region which he had been charged to defend prostrate before the invader. Urged on by the Dauphin, Arnaud tried to organize a counterattack. The result was a humiliating fiasco. The archpriest led his own company and a miscellaneous force of local men east in Knowles's tracks until they came to Malicorne. After a brief and ineffective siege of the place, he withdrew in circumstances which are obscure, but were evidently regarded at the Dauphin's court as discreditable. So, likely a little money changed hands. There was worse to come. On his retreat, the archpriest laid siege to the castle of Courval in the eastern Nervais. Courval was occupied by a splinter group from Knowles's group, commanded by an adventurer from Cheshire called John Waldboeuf. There he was captured by a sortie party and forced to sign a ransom contract for an enormous sum. His troops dispersed without achieving anything. At the beginning of December 1358, Robert Knowles's band reached the River Yonne north of Auxerre. The departure of some of his companies on their own adventures and the need to leave garrisons in Chateau Neuf and Malicorne had by now rather depleted his numbers, and it is unlikely that he had more than about 1,400 men with him. On December the 8th, they captured Regens, a large fortified manor on the left bank of the river which belonged to the bishops of Auxerre. This place became the headquarters of Knowles himself and shared base of at least three English companies, those of David Hetton, John Dalton, and Nicholas Tamworth. Hetton was already well known as a garrison commander in the Lower Normandy. Dalton was a retainer of the Duke of Lancaster, whose background was rather similar. Tamworth was probably one of Knowles' lieutenants on the Breton March. All of them had become notorious in the Auxerre and northern Burgundy during the following months. Another Englishman called William Starkey, a criminal of ill repute from Chester, installed himself on the opposite side of Yonne in the castle of the Counts of Tonnier at Ligny de Châtel. Auxerre proved to be a natural limit of Knowles's range. East and south of him lay the Duchy of Burgundy, an ancient territory with a cohesive nobility and large cities, which conserved something of its ability to recruit troops and raise taxes. The Duke of Burgundy, Philip de Rivere, was a minor, and the direction of affairs was in the hands of the Queen of France, who had been appointed as his guardian. She was a woman of limited political skills and perennially short of funds, but her council included some able soldiers and administrators. They had been able to build up the garrison along the northeast march of the duchy at Semur, Avalon, Montreal, and Montbard, and to assemble more than 2,000 men along the border as Knowles approached. Further assistance had been summoned from the Count of Savoy. As a result, the English companies made no serious attempt on the Duchy of Burgundy. Some of them turned north instead and tried to penetrate into Champagne and the upper valley of the Seine. Moving up the Roman road, they established a forward base at Ix-en-Auth, a small village clustered by a fortified manor house. About 400 men gathered there in the new year. The great cathedral city of Troyes stood 20 miles to the east, which was an inviting target. Troyes was also a major center of cloth manufacture, filled with rich churches and mansions, the monuments of an even richer past. Its defenses were weak. They were ill-kept ditches and a circuit of low earthworks. Two wooden forts stood in front of the principal entrances. Otherwise, there was nothing. The urgent need to do something about this had been pointed out by the royal bailie as long ago as 1346, but the project had been lost. Nevertheless, the place was energetically defended in 1359. The leading spirits were the bishop, Henri of Poitiers, a resolute and worldly military clergyman, and a count of Vandemont, one of the Dauphin's lieutenants in Champagne. On January 12, 1359, the English appeared before the walls. Vandamont and the bishop led their men through the gates, followed by a horde of armed citizens. The English were unused to being challenged in open country. They were caught unprepared and routed. They left 120 dead on the field and lost about the same number as prisoners. In all, about two-thirds of their strength was gone. The survivors returned to their forts around Aix and set fire to them. They then retreated back to the Auxerrois. Knowles' army remained in the Auxerrois for nearly 5 months, an altogether exceptional period for a body of men of that size to stay in one place. A rough territorial division was worked out between the garrisons of Regens and Ligny. This left Starkey with the territory east of the Yonne, while the garrisons of the Regens was despoiled the West Bank. Starkey was particularly active. He extended his ransom districts east across the county of Tonnerre and south of the border of the Duchy of Burgundy. The inhabitants of the villages around Auxerre joined in the pillage as the only way of feeding themselves. The situation at Auxerre was itself appalling. The city had once been one of the great river ports in eastern France, surrounded by famous vineyards of the Auxerrois and by those of neighboring districts of Tonnerre and Chablis, which produced the most expensive white wines in Europe. The citizens lived on the wine trade and on the traffic of the Seine. The city must have suffered grievously from the partial closure of the Seine at Melun just before the vintage of 1358. The destruction of the vineyards by the English completed the disaster. Now, the walls of Auxerrois dated from 1160. They were not easy to defend, partly because of the steeply sloped hillsides on which the city was built, partly because of their irregularity. The legacy of the clutter, demolitions, and repairs over the years, and partly because of their great length, nearly 2 miles for a city whose male population of military age was probably much less than the official reckoning of 2,000. The townsmen had expelled their garrison a year before, at a time when many cities in France had come to distress professional soldiers of whatever allegiance and resolved to defend their city themselves. Yet they had neither the skills nor the experience to do so. There was no obvious leaders. The lord of the city, Jean III of Chalon, was a prisoner in England. His son was living in the citadel but had no troops. On January the 10th, 1359, the Bishop of Auxerre lay dying in his palace, attended by the clergy of his cathedral, swords in hands, as the bells rang out the alarm and the English launched the first of a succession of assaults against the walls. 2 months later, on March the 10th, 1359, catastrophe befell Auxerre. About 1,000 men drawn from Regens and the surrounding garrisons of the regions approached the Porte d'Anglais. The watchmen were not at their posts. No one raised the alarm as the English scaled the wall, opened the gates to their companies, waiting outside, and spread through the streets. Before the sun had risen, the whole city, including the citadel, was in their hands. When it was all over, Knowles, who still ranked no higher than a squire, received his knighthood at the hands of two of his subordinates. It was the first time that a city of comparable importance had been captured since the fall of Poitiers to Henry of Lancaster in 1346. But there was no repetition of the frenzied sack of Poitiers. This was to be a careful appropriation of the city's wealth by disciplined professional thieves whose procedures were calculated to maximize their profits. Hardly anyone was killed. Soldiers posted at the gates stopped the inhabitants from leaving so that they could be assessed for ransom. The floors were dug up and secret caches hacked out of the walls in which they had been hidden. In the cathedral, the great silver lamps which hung before the high altar were taken down and the treasury emptied. The portable booty of the city was more than 20 churches, must have been prodigious. Some English reckoning gives the total value of the spoils at 500,000 moutons. No one tried to count the value of the personal ransoms. When the English had taken everything that could be found and carried away, they set about extracting the value of the rest. Knowles gathered together the leading citizens of Auxerre and stated his terms for refraining from the physical destruction of the city. After the prolonged negotiations, the inhabitants agreed to ransom their buildings for 50,000 moutons payable within 3 months, and an extra 50,000 payable in default. The citizens had the utmost difficulty in finding the money to redeem these pledges. The monks of the great abbey of Saint Germain dug out treasures which they had managed to conceal, included the jeweled reliquary of the saint, and pledged them to the conqueror. A deputation was sent to Paris to borrow from moneylenders on the security of other choice items from the treasury of Saint-Germain. But some of them refused to return, and the rest were robbed on the road home and lost everything that they had collected. The citizens managed to placate the English with a payment on account of 60 pearls, said to be worth 10,000 moutons, in exchange for which they received back the front of the reliquary. Later in the year, they were able to borrow another 32,000 florins by mortgaging future vintages of their wines to a syndicate of Parisian vintners. Further sums were raised by levying tolls on goods passing the city wall, but Knowles was never entirely paid off. Part of the debt remained outstanding until many years later. He resolved to make his peace with God and was obliged by the Pope to make reparation for his sins. Moved by pity and remorse from the suffering of the city, and by the love of God and the reverence for the Holy Father, Knowles remitted what was remained and surrendered the reliquary of Saint-Germain. A few days after the sack of Rochers, the cardinals of Perigord and Urgal passed through the region on their way back to Avignon. After the failure of the longest papal peacemaking mission of the 14th century, their train made an imposing sight as it moved down the Dijon road. Passing Guise-sur-Seine was attacked by an armed band. The cardinals and their attendants were robbed of everything that they had. The sources for this, the 100 Years' War by Perrault, the 100 Years' War by Nylands, and the 100 Years' War, Volume 2, Trial by Fire, by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed the looting of the area. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.